and they're just sheep following the herd. And contrarian doctors like Dr. Z-Dog, you know, in 2019, he sent out this tweet. Here's some advice to medical students. You know, if 4 out of 5 doctors do something, make sure you're the fifth, you know, be the different one.
That sounds like a great way to fail your board exam, actually.
Right. I mean, you know.
Show about medicine.
Recorded in sterile conditions.
The guy you just heard is Dr. Christopher Labos.
And the other guy is Jonathan Jarry. I'm a doctor, but he's not.
Sorry that I did biomedical research instead. Jeez.
And we're going to look at the evidence behind medical topics. And the show is
called... Wait. No, I want to say it.
I want to say it.
I want to say it. I came up with it. It's the body of... It's the body of evidence.
You totally stole that from Madonna.
We are joined by a returning guest, Dr. Jonathan Howard.
Two Jonathans? Madness!
No, however, will we keep track? He is an associate professor in the departments of neurology and psychiatry and the chief of the neurology service at Bellevue Hospital Center. He is also a regular writer for the website Science-Based Medicine. And we have chatted previously about his book, Cognitive Errors and Diagnostic Mistakes, A Case-Based Guide to Critical Thinking in Medicine. Welcome back, other Jonathan.
We missed you.
Thank you guys very much for having me. Happy to be here.
So we wanted to bring you back to discuss an alarming phenomenon that we have witnessed during the pandemic, which is the rise of the contrarian doctor. Of course, there have always been medical doctors who, for example, are anti-vaccine and who more generally sort of radically disagree with the scientific consensus or with best practices in a given field. But during the COVID-19 pandemic and also aided by monetizable content delivery platforms like Substack, YouTube, podcasts, we have seen a meteoric rise in the influence that some of them have. We're going to focus primarily on Dr. Vinay Prasad, about whom you have written a lot, but I do foresee him being a convenient case study that will allow us to talk about the phenomenon as a whole. So perhaps for our listeners who do not know who Dr. Prasad is, can you briefly describe who he is, what he does, and why he was on many people's radars before the pandemic?
Yeah, so he is a hematologist and oncologist at the University of San Francisco, University of California, San Francisco. I've never met him. We once exchanged a couple polite emails. Nothing personal here. And before the pandemic, he wrote this book called Ending Medical Reversal, and he wrote it with Dr. Adam Sifu. And I thought it was a really wonderful book, just really talking about the problems of evidence-based medicine and really how we can do better. I mean, what it was talking about is sort of, you know, one day this knee surgery works and the next day it doesn't, you know, after 10 million people had this knee surgery. So how can medicine get better? And how can they improve? And I thought he had a lot of wise things to say. Looking back, there were some criticisms of him at the time that I think are applicable to today. For example, he focused, of course, mostly on his specialty oncology and criticized a lot of trials there, saying they weren't very well run, the endpoints weren't very good, and people said to him, you should do a trial. You know, it's a little bit, you know, you're just kind of sitting on the sidelines saying, here's what you should do. And that is definitely the case during the pandemic. So beforehand, but I think he was a respected person, you know, a little bit of a gadfly. He definitely seemed to like to draw attention to himself, but wasn't famous. I don't think too many people knew him. He was a respected person.
Yeah, I mean, and Prasad also, even pre-pandemic, interesting bit of behavior. He was infamous for blocking anyone who disagreed with him on Twitter. I mean, he blocked me early on. I'm not even sure why. The joke, of course, is that he's blocked most of Med Twitter at this point, so much so that there's a Twitter account dedicated to this called Blocked by Vinay, which is interesting.
Yeah. And I will say I disagreed with him strongly on one thing before the pandemic, and that is the value of debunking pseudoscience.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
So he would say, essentially, why does someone need to go through 4 years of medical school, 6 years of residency, you know, whatever, all of this training, all of this studying, all of this expertise to tell you that cupping doesn't work? It's a waste of skills. It's a waste of resources. A high school student could do it. And I disagreed with him about that because while I agree that, yes, it's easy to debunk cupping, it's not always easy to see the lessons that lie within. You know, someone who debunks cupping hopefully really isn't just debunking cupping as much as, you know, what makes people fall for this? What sort of goes wrong and how can we fix this? And during the pandemic, he made it seem like his only opponents were people who did nothing but debunk cupping. Although, of course, I've never written anything about cupping, but most of us were really into debunking the anti-vaccine movement. Mm-hmm. And he kind of treated that like it was a waste of time as well. Yeah. Like, you're not convincing anyone. What's the point? And I think it's very interesting that he fell into many of the traps that we were all describing when it came to COVID.
Yeah, it's a little bit like, the skeptical movement often gets accused of just like debunking Sasquatch and like, who cares? But there are, as you pointed out, there are fundamental lessons in good thinking, in evidence gathering that comes from studying things like Sasquatch and the claims about the Loch Ness Monster, especially since they are not typically... they're not going to trigger somebody's emotions. Like, it's not an emotionally or an identity forming belief for most people. So you can use these more neutral subjects to really think more about how to do good science and what bad science looks like. And then you can apply these to topics that may have more relevance and that may be more emotionally loaded for a lot of people.
No, that's exactly right. So he would read an article about cupping and think, this is an article about cupping,
right,
as opposed to critical thinking, evaluating evidence, that sort of thing, which comes in handy.
Well, the other thing, too, is that we sometimes underestimate how popular some of these things are. Like, you could look at them and say, like, well, this is nothing to me. And yet it can be very popular. So, you know, cupping is very popular. A lot of alternative medicine is very popular, and it costs people a lot of money. And a lot of the conspiracy theories that circulated, on social media and the internet, yes, they may have been, or they may have seemed patently absurd to you, but they are believed and by a lot of people and become harmful. I wrote an article once about the soccer players dying, you know, after the vaccine. And I wrote that article because I couldn't think of a better topic for my weekly article. And I was like, okay, well, this will just be one of the articles that doesn't get much traction. And it was huge because so many people believed that. And so you sometimes, if your goal is to educate the public, sometimes you have to meet them on their ground and address the issues that they think are important, not necessarily the issues that you think are important.
Yeah, I mean, what he would say to that is that skeptics sort of talk down to these people, that we're here to dunk on them and mock them and make fun of them, not actually help them. And we're really not changing anyone's mind as much as we are sort of gathering in a circle and patting ourselves on the back for being so much smarter than people. And, you know, he's right about that. There's a little bit of condescension and how could people believe this stuff in the skeptics movement. And you know, that shouldn't exist. You know, we should try to have sympathy at least from people who are fooled by these and injured by these. I mean, I don't think we need to have sympathy for some of the, you know, lead purveyors of them. So he had some reasonable points there, I think. And, you know, I say this just because I want to, you know, I want your listeners to know I'm trying to engage with his ideas, you know, seeing them in the best possible light, you know, the principle of charity here, you know, and in good faith.
So, yeah. So speaking of Dr. Prasad pointing at us and accusing us of sort of being in a studio with other people that agree with us and denigrating the people around us, that takes us to the COVID-19 pandemic era. And we're going to play a 90-second clip. This is from the YouTube channel of Dr. Zubin Damania, a.k.a. ZDog MD. You can think of him as a Joe Rogan of the medical world. He's doing a podcast with Dr. Vinay Prasad, and their guest is Dr. Marty Makary. The video podcast is from December 4th of 2021, so a year ago. Just to sort of give you an idea of the kind of contrarianism that we will be talking about. So the first man you will hear is ZDog, followed by Makary, and finally Prasad.
We're unmasked, unboosted, and unrepentant, Marty. That's
Well, I'm an unboosted male. That's my preferred pronoun, by the way.
Oh, is that your pronoun? Yeah. Unboosted male?
Yeah.
Yes, my pronouns are it, they, those, and currently unboosted because I got Moderna, which apparently kicks ass.
Yeah.
Like, it's a good vaccine.
Yeah.
I'm 48. I don't have a lot of comorbidities. I have some clotting stuff, but I've never clotted. It's just like theoretical 23andMe. Thank you very much. So how about you? Are you boosted?
You know too much about yourself. It's a HIPAA violation to ask someone if they're.
Never mind. You don't have to.
Privacy is dead, my friend.
I do see that people do say that. That's not true. It's not HIPAA. You can, of course, ask anyone their status, but no, I haven't gotten my booster yet. And boosters.
You mean this week you haven't got you? Because you do weekly boosters, I'm sure.
Well,
right?
Eventually we're all going to have to keep boosting.
You know, my vaccine card looks like one of those like frequent flyer like coffee cards where they punch the hole. Like I boosted here and boosted here and boosted here. And when I get 10 boosters, Fauci sends me a Fauci bobblehead that says, I am the science.
I'm getting my booster sent with the GNC nutrition vitamins.
They have the same evidence. Yeah.
What are the odds we get canceled now with the three-time canceling incumbents?
I get yelled at for platforming each one of you separately. Now all we need to do is bring Jay Bhattacharya and Monica Gandhi here, and we'll have like the horsemen of the apocalypse. And Twitter will just melt. It will just turn into goo.
Nice.
Yeah, so there it was. Wow. So that was just before the Omicron wave, by the way. There would be so much to unpack here, from the derision of progressive politics to the politicization of public health measures, from the reference to cancel culture to the methodology on boosters. But what was your first inkling, Jonathan, of Prasad's current opinions about the pandemic? Like, do you remember what made you think, oh, he's going with contrarianism on this one? And we should keep in mind throughout this discussion that he graduated from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in 2014.
Yeah, that is some clip for sure. It definitely reminds me of how anti-vaxxers talked about other vaccines before the pandemic. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that is, you know, exactly what, you know, Dr. Prasad reminds me of. So, you know, I'm trying to think of when I first sort of really disagreed with him in some way. I mean, the first time I did so in print was actually my first article for Science-Based Medicine, which was published in May 2021. At that time, Dr. Prasad, along with another doctor, a doctor from Johns Hopkins and a mathematician, wrote an article for the BMJ, British Medical Journal, saying that vaccines for children should not get emergency use authorization. And fortunately, they did. But if we had listened to that article, no healthy child under the age of 12 today would be vaccinated. They said maybe high-risk children could get vaccinated, but and children between the ages of 12 and 15 would only be able to have been vaccinated this summer. That's when the vaccine was fully approved for them. And I thought Dr. Prasad's article was very poor. It was fact-free. It contained zero facts about pediatric COVID. It contained one reference to the swine flu debacle of 1976, where some people got Guillain-Barré syndrome, a neurological condition, after the vaccine. Mm-hmm. They did not explain what the difference between an emergency use authorization was and full authorization. And it was really nothing, no extra testing, just waiting. And they didn't really say what would be gained. And by that time, several hundred children have died of COVID. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, probably 300 to 400 children had died of COVID in a year. I don't know. That sounds like a lot to me, right?
Yeah.
And tens of thousands more had been hospitalized. But all this article said is that children have less risk than adults. And they all thought the pandemic was going away at that time. You know, cases were very low, and they didn't consider the possibility of variants. And my article did, and sadly, Delta arrived a couple months later, and Omicron arrived, you know, after that. And in the past year after that article, 1,000 children died of COVID, and tens of thousands of more children were hospitalized. And these numbers would have been much higher if no children had been vaccinated. And what's interesting is that Dr. Prasad's crusade, and I will call it that, against the pediatric COVID vaccine began in winter 2021 before any children were vaccinated. He was saying, you know, COVID is one kills one in a million children. That's a false statistic. COVID, you know, is like the flu. Also a false statistic. COVID is going away, or the pandemic is abating. The vaccine's going to cause fevers. So he had his mind made up before a single child had been vaccinated. He hasn't changed his mind at all. So when he claims to follow the evidence, not really.
It's interesting also because there is this also this appeal to civility that I see with certain types of people, because way early on May 15th, 2020, he tweeted in defense of Dr. John Ioannidis, who had just published a terrible study estimating COVID mortality. It had been lambasted by experts, but he had gone on Fox News to talk about it. So Prasad tweeted, quote, "Our issue is that if academic disagreement gets so personal and so political, we are doomed. It's worse than COVID. Stanford authors deserve to have their study gutted, but not the personal attacks. That is a slippery slope, even if they go on bad TV shows." And it's something that I see again and again. This I mean, you know, on the one hand, it's like, oh, cancel culture, they're coming for us, they're coming for us. And then on the other hand, it's like, well, you know, we need to listen to everyone and be very kind to our really bad ideas that are not backed up by any good evidence.
Yeah, I mean, so just listen to you know, the clip of him, you know, that you played. I mean, you know, that's that they routinely mock people and shame people who are trying to avoid the virus. You know, these people are just thought of just pathetic, just the worst. They're not really living.
Masks, right? There was a whole thing about the he saw a couple wearing masks on an airplane.
That was Z-Dog, and it just
that was Z-Dog, right?
Yeah, really bothered him. You know, and Prasad has done this too. You know, I saw someone wearing a mask at the gym. What a doesn't say what a loser. You know, but this got to be horrible for him. You know, what's he afraid of? You know, you know, constantly. You know, mocking and shaming people, just, you know, exactly as they did in that quip, you know, my pronouns are boosted in, or, you know, whatever. Yeah. And it's, you know, I think a shameful way for doctors to comport themselves in public. Not that I'm a, you know, listen, you know, I probably have, you know, behaved that way a few times, but, you know, it's not the best of what we do. And yeah, the article that you're talking about is something that he co-wrote with Jeffrey Flier, the former dean of Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Ioannidis, first of all, he has not been silenced. He has been an extremely influential voice this pandemic. He has been the opposite of silenced. He's become kind of a mini celebrity. He was on TV. You know, he was talking almost daily to Dr. Scott Atlas, who was Trump's coronavirus czar. So Dr. Ioannidis has not been silenced. Apparently, there have been some threats made against him or his mother, which is unacceptable. So let me just condemn that unequivocally. But he has not been silenced. And when that article was written about Dr. Ioannidis, there was no scientific dispute. He had just gotten basic facts wrong. I can give you many examples. So on April 9th, 2020, he predicted in an article in the Washington Post that 40,000 Americans would die of COVID this season. Okay, so that was April 9th, 2020. By that time, 22,000 Americans had already died. And on that day, just under 2,000 people died. Okay, and yet here he was predicting 18,000 more people were going to die this season. Okay, so the good thing about a prediction like this is we knew very, 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 very soon whether that prediction was going to be right. And indeed, the prediction was wrong. And, you know, the United States exceeded 40,000 deaths on April 17th, 2020. On that day, Dr. Ioannidis gave an interview where he said COVID is much less lethal than the flu. Our reaction to COVID is much worse, etc. By the time Dr. Flier and Dr. Prasad wrote their article, something like 60,000 people had died. So, you know, just a few days after that. So, even though Dr. Ioannidis was just wrong about everything, they framed him as someone who just thought differently. And it's been a very sad fact this pandemic that people who have made these wildly irresponsible predictions that age horribly within a week are said to be having, you know, just thinking differently. Another example from Ioannidis is he went on Fox News and said 1 out of 1,000 people die of COVID. Okay, that's the fatality rate. By that point, about 10,000 New Yorkers had already died. So if 10,000 people had died and 1 out of 1,000 dies of COVID, that requires 10 million infections. In fact, there are about 8 million New Yorkers. So he calculated that 120% or so of New York had been infected with COVID by April 2020. So he just made these patently sort of ridiculous claims. And as the pandemic progressed, Dr. Ioannidi, you know, very rapidly started spreading doubt. You know, he couldn't be wrong. He couldn't be wrong. What was really wrong is that these people were dying with COVID, not of COVID. Mm-hmm. That the virus was just found in their nose on their when they were about to die from cancer anyway. Death certificates can't be trusted. And doctors are killing patients through premature intubations. So this is the sort of stuff that QAnon people spread. It seems crazy for me to say this, but he spread what became kind of QAnon myths, or he absorbed them. It's really hard to sort of know where, you know, who got what idea.
Right. Who got infected with this and who shared
yeah.
it?
I mean, yeah. The problem is a lot of these things still persist. Like I still have people say, like, yeah, but are they in hospital mm-hmm. with COVID or from COVID? Like this is, and these are journalists. It's an enduring myth. I mean, even our government has started saying that. There's been like government right. communiques about that. They're like, well, the number of hospitalizations are up, but most of these people are there with COVID, not of COVID. And I'm like, Jesus.
So I'll say as the pandemic progressed, that became more common. Like, yeah. you know, you'd see people in psychiatric units, but that was not true in April 2020. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you that. And we're sort of learning that maybe COVID can do a lot of these things, and that even an incidental, hospitalizations that we think are incidental, maybe they're not. And there was an interesting study of trauma victims, actually, who were incidentally found to have COVID, did worse. So it's really it's not always clear that it's such a benign thing. But, you know, at least now at this stage in the pandemic, I do think some incidental hospitalizations are a real thing. But back then, he was just, you know, he wasn't even saying hospitalizations, he was saying deaths.
Yeah.
And if you look at these are people who are dying incidentally with COVID. And if you just look at the headlines from that time, they are, you know, forklifts moving bodies into refrigerated morgues out of, you know, two New York City hospitals. These were not people who are just dying of normal causes when we happen to find COVID in their nose. And he was just promoting these crazy sort of myths. Yet Dr. Prasad and Dr. Flyer said he's just thinking differently. Don't be mean to him.
It was really shocking to me because, I mean, I have met Dr. John Ioannidis on two separate occasions. And in fact, one of the talks that he gave at the hospital where I was doing a PhD was like one of the factors that made me reconsider the PhD and decide to quit because I saw that I was seeing a lot of bad thinking and bad science around me. And I couldn't see myself graduating from this lab. And it was in part because of the talk that he had given.
He ruined your life.
No. Quite the opposite, I would say. I mean, he opened my eyes up to bad science. And in a way, it's why I started doing science communication. So, like, he has been, like, instrumental in my origin story. And I met him at an event where he was a speaker, and I chatted with him briefly, and he struck me as being, you know, very kind, very humble. He was a superstar in the world of meta science. How did he get this so wrong?
So I don't know. I've never met him. I've, you know, only read him and heard him. And I would also add that I was a fan pre-pandemic. You know, in my non-best-selling book on cognitive errors, I quoted him several times.
Right.
I think a lot of people underestimated COVID in March and April yeah. of 2020. I think that was a very common thing Dr. Paul Offit did. He said, you know, COVID is going to cause, you know, 1/10 of the deaths of flu. And Dr. Paul Offit is one of the world's leading vaccine experts. And a lot of doctors on Twitter did too. You know, there was a Twitter poll. Someone just said in February 2020, are you worried about COVID? And a lot of people said, not me. So I think he just underestimated it. And here's where I think the problem is. And this really is what separates him from Dr. Offit. He couldn't just say, I was wrong. He couldn't just say I was wrong. He had committed in public many, many times and in print, in journals at this point. He was already writing in medical journals, not just in newspapers, that, you know, there's exaggerated case fatality rates, exaggerated spread. He said on March 19th in some journal, if we had devoted, you know, these, you know, 1/10 of these efforts to preventing flu deaths, we would save many more lives this year. And he couldn't just say, you know what, I underestimated this, I got it wrong. That's my hunch. That's my hunch.
Whereas Paul Offit famously said, if you're going to be wrong in front of as many people as possible.
Yeah.
Like, exactly, do it on CNN.
And the thing, too, is that a lot of what he was saying, like, you, I need this, was not necessarily, well, I don't want to say it wasn't necessarily wrong, because it was wrong, but you can understand how he got there given what was going on at the time. Like, people were saying that the case fatality rate with COVID was like 5%, 10%, like, you know, truly like excessive numbers. It's obviously not that high.
Right. And I also do not think his concerns about lockdowns were misplaced.
Yeah.
You know, he was worried that if you completely shut down the economy and locked people in their houses for months and months and months on end, like China, you'd have a lot of social problems as a result of that.
Right.
I think it's always worthwhile to think about the worst case scenario on both sides, right?
Yeah.
What's the worst that can happen if we lock down? You know, would there be a lot of domestic abuse? You know, who knows? These decisions have to be made really quickly, of course. None of us have ever lived through a pandemic, but his thinking about the worst case scenario only went in one direction. He never really considered, what if I'm wrong about this virus? And people, I should say, you know, knew what the virus could do. People made very accurate predictions at that time. One of the predictions out of London was that 2.4 million Americans would die. Dr. Ioannidis went on Fox News and said, this is an error of, you know, astronomical proportions. That estimate of 2.4 million American deaths, there's an important caveat there. He said, if no one does anything, if no one changes their behavior at all or tries to stop the virus at all, 2.4 million Americans will die in 3 months. Looking back, that's probably accurate, right? If we just totally went, maybe even more. We just, if we had no idea what viruses were. But Dr. Ioannidis just dismissed that out of hand. And he talked about the virus in a very confident way, saying that it was seasonal, saying that you would have permanent immunity, saying things like that people under the age of 65 have no risk of death. The infection fatality rate for healthy people under the age of 65% is zero, he said. And he never really considered that the virus could do things besides kill people, which is sort of a very common theme this pandemic. Even if you get really sick and are hospitalized for 2 weeks and you survive, you could still be pretty bad shape. It's a pretty miserable experience. So I think he got it wrong on every level and just has kind of had a hard time saying that.
There is a sort of defeatist attitude from these contrarian doctors that I think starts to fly in the face of medicine. I want to bring this back to Dr. Prasad. He would later say that fear of long COVID is irrational insofar as it exists. And I forget when exactly he tweeted that, but you have to accept it, he wrote. Now, is this something, because I'm not a medical doctor, is this something that is taught in medical school for future doctors to tell their patients that illness is just inevitable and should simply be accepted?
No. COVID gets treated very differently than other viruses for reasons that are unclear to me. People who are outraged about the measles outbreak now in Ohio that's hospitalized about 26 kids are passive in the face of 100,000 children or more, you know, being hospitalized with COVID. So, and I think with Dr. Prasad, it's a little bit sort of the same thing, that he committed very early on to this idea that COVID is mild for, you know, anyone but grandma, and, sort of had a hard time considering even that he was wrong. And I think in one of the worst articles of the entire pandemic, in an article called Should We Let Children Get Omicron, which was published in February 2022, right after the deadliest month of the pandemic for children, which was January 2022, about 180 children died of COVID that month alone. And during the peak of it, around 1,000 children were hospitalized every day, being newly hospitalized every day. And in that article, he said COVID-19 is less deadly to children than car crashes and drownings, which we accept as a matter of course.
Wow. Except we don't.
Just let that sink in for a minute. The absurdity of it. We do
the callousness of it.
Yeah, we do not let children die of car crashes and drownings of matter of course.
Right.
We go through great lengths to prevent those things. And if someone invented a new car seat that saved the lives of 200 children per year, that would be a great thing. That person would be, you know, deserve a big pat on the back.
And in fact, we pass laws forcing people to build fences around their pools to prevent child drownings, even when those people don't have children, because a child might come over to your house. So we do a lot of very invasive stuff to prevent child drownings because it's such a pointless death that is easily prevented.
Right. And, you know, listen, before the pandemic in 2018 or 19, actually probably every year, I think, the American Academy of Pediatrics would launch a sort of anti-drowning campaign. And no one criticized them. No one said it's just 1,000 children per year. We should, you know, just accept this as a matter of course. Or that's only 0.00013% of children, or children are more likely to die of suicide. None of these arguments were made against the American Academy of Pediatrics anti-drowning campaign. Like I said, COVID gets treated differently for reasons I can't figure out, that people aren't, like Dr. Prasad, aren't even willing to suggest a simple vaccine. And the way that he speaks about pediatric COVID deaths as something that we just have to accept stands in marked contrast to how he talks about side effects of the vaccine. With children's deaths, you know, in April 2021, he tweeted, you know, 19 children died of COVID this month out of a population of 330 million. So, you know, just brush off 19 children dying of a vaccine the vaccine wasn't available at the time, but it is now. So 19 children dying in a single month of a vaccine preventable disease. You got to consider that there's 330 million people in this country. Meanwhile, a child gets myocarditis from the vaccine, from which he will probably recover. We can go into this in more detail if you want. That's totally unacceptable. This is a travesty. The media needs to cover this. This is not mild. This is, he's going to have permanent heart conditions that he has to worry about. In fact, it's very interesting. He, with a couple other doctors, like Dr. John Mandrola, wrote an article, I think in May 2021, saying there is no such thing as COVID heart, where they said, even in the sickest of the sick, COVID's effects on the heart appear to be modest. People who've recovered from COVID have no special reason to worry about their heart. 2 months later, a couple cases of vaccine myocarditis start coming out. This, you know, and again, you get this sort of histrionic language, you know, this is not mild, you know, the exact same condition. They talk about it in completely different ways, depending on one thing. And that thing isn't the severity. It's not the survival rate. It's not the heart damage. It's whether it was caused by the virus or the vaccine. That's it.
But this is classic, I mean, textbook COVID-19 anti-vaccination movement talking point. It's you demonize the vaccine and you make sure that people think that the virus is innocuous. Because Prasad became obsessed with vaccine-induced myocarditis. And so you focus on the alleged harms of the vaccine, you blow them out of proportions, and you look at the virus and say, the virus is nothing. Would you say that Vinay Prasad has become anti-vaccine? Like, what is his stance on the COVID vaccines and on vaccines more generally, from what you've gathered?
Yeah, I don't see why I would not call him anti-vaccine. He does not want children to get vaccinated. He does not feel it should be part of the routine vaccination schedule. And replace any of his articles, take out the word COVID and put in the word measles, and you'll get an anti-vaccine article from 2019. Matter of fact, I use one of those new AI technologies, and I was like, write an article by an anti-vaccine doctor about the COVID vaccine, and it spit out a perfect Vinay Prasad article. And, you know, he makes all these, you know, he would say, you know, oh, listen, I'm very pro-vaccine. I think, you know, kids should definitely get the MMR. The fact that we're pushing the COVID vaccine is decreasing trust in the MMR, and measles is a much more serious disease. Well, I think the last time measles killed anyone in America was 2014. I think the last time it killed any child was 1990 or 1991. There was a measles outbreak in Philadelphia. I'm sure Dr. Prasad doesn't know any of this because he doesn't know the history of vaccines and the anti-vaccine movements and previous outbreaks.
We'll send him
outbreaks.
Books by Dr. Paul Offit.
You know, but COVID killed 180 kids in January 2022, you know, so that, you know, that makes it a pretty serious disease. A matter of fact, before the pandemic, all vaccine-preventable diseases combined used to kill about 300 children. But of course, you know, I'm kind of accepting his frame where you have to compare one disease or the other. Like, if measles is worse than COVID, then we should only give the measles vaccine. And that's a ridiculous frame because we should vaccinate children against any disease that can kill them or injure them. We shouldn't have any child die for lack of a vaccine. And Dr. Prasad disagrees with me about that. He feels, apparently, some children should die for lack of a vaccine.
Yeah. It's interesting that, you know, the COVID vaccine was probably the first vaccine that had to be evaluated by a lot of people from scratch, right? Most people grew up or went through medical school presented with a vaccine schedule saying, this is the vaccine schedule. And they said, okay. But the minute they had to add to that vaccine schedule, that's where you started to see some of this pushback with the COVID vaccine and to a lesser degree with the shingles vaccine, right? Well, it's not really cost effective. Or with the HPV vaccine in boys, well, it's not really cost effective. So it's always easier to accept something when it was presented to you during your formative years. But when you have to accept something new, I think that's where a lot of people fall down and they have trouble accepting new things. They have trouble changing and they have trouble changing their minds and acknowledging that cost effectiveness, at least, is a very subjective thing. And the public's willingness to accept stuff changes. Case in point being the HPV vaccine in boys, where a lot of people said it's not cost effective. And a lot of then subsequently people said, well, you know what? It's still preventing disease in young boys. Why wouldn't we do that?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if Dr. Prasad were here, he would say to me, you know, there's no evidence from a randomized controlled trial that the COVID vaccine saves lives or keeps children out of the hospital. And I would say many things. Yeah. You know, I'd say this is true of the HPV vaccine. There's no evidence from a randomized controlled trial that the HPV vaccine prevents cancer, which is a fact.
That's true. Yeah, we covered that. On our HPV episode.
Right. There's tons of evidence now that it prevents cancer. So, you know, please don't take that. None of our listeners, you know, think that about the HPV vaccine. But that's one of the main anti-vaccine talking points against the HPV vaccine. They say randomized controlled trials are the gold standard of evidence. Until you can present me a randomized controlled trial that the HPV vaccine prevents cancer, I'm not going to accept it.
Right. So let's dig into that, because I think this is what Dr. David Gorski refers to as methodolatry, right? Yeah. The idolatry of the pyramid of evidence. Well, if it's not an RCT, we don't know what the answer is.
Yeah. Yes. And just so we don't scare people about the HPV vaccine, what it actually did was it prevented the precancerous lesion that led to cervical cancer. And a lot of people very reasonably and very correctly said, okay, good enough, off we go, because you're not going to wait for people to develop cancer. Obviously, that would be ridiculous and that would take decades and not years.
Right. And that's exactly what we did with these COVID vaccines. We knew that they prevented COVID. We surmised that they would prevent hospitalizations and deaths. In the adult mRNA vaccine trials, for example, both the Pfizer and the Moderna, just one person died of COVID. So we started using these vaccines before we had proof from randomized controlled trials, which still doesn't exist, that the vaccines save lives. We kind of assumed that if they prevented severe COVID and COVID in general, they would prevent people from dying of COVID. Like, this is not some great leap. And one thing that's interesting is about 25,000 children were involved in COVID randomized controlled trials. That's not a small number of children. Dr. Prasad will never tell you that fact, but that's a big number of children. So these vaccines were studied in randomized controlled trials of children. And there's now over 20 observational trials showing that the vaccine has already kept a ton of children safe, a ton of children out of the hospitals. You know, these studies all say things like out of 250 vaccine eligible teens who were hospitalized with COVID, only two were partially vaccinated and they stayed 2 days, you know, all seven children who died were unvaccinated. And Dr. Prasad just dismisses them all with a brush of a hand. He says observational trials cannot be used to support vaccines because they could possibly confound it. Every single observational trial can be dismissed as long as it supports vaccines. Of course, that's where he gets his information about vaccine myocarditis. So observational trials are only good to show vaccine harms. And I'm really not misquoting him here. He did a debate written debate with Adam Sifu about these vaccines. And he made that statement. He said, observational studies can be used to support vaccines, but they're plagued by confounding. So he just dismisses about 20 studies, all of which point in the exact same direction that the vaccine, you know, saves lives and keeps children safe and out of hospitals. And he just dismisses them all with a brush of a hand.
I brought up the anti-vaccine movement and its talking points a few minutes earlier. I think it's important to mention you have a personal reason for being familiar with anti-vaccine tropes. What is it?
Yeah. So I became very interested in the anti-vaccine movement about a decade ago, when someone I trained with, a woman by the name of Dr. Kelly Brogan, became virulently anti-vaccine. She is what everyone would sort of recognize as a quack. She doesn't even believe in germ theory. She doesn't believe viruses cause disease. She doesn't believe HIV causes AIDS. She thinks everyone is dying of fear. She is against all vaccines. And she became pretty mini famous in, you know, before the pandemic. She was platformed by Gwyneth Paltrow in Goop in the South by Southwest Festival. Kind of like Dr. Prasad, she's very good speaker. She's very good on her feet. She's very comfortable on a stage, you know, very, you know, presentable. So I became fascinated by the anti-vaccine movement because Dr. Brogan was smart. She went to MIT and Cornell. I worked with her for 4 years and, you know, on and off. You know, she was nice, nothing personal. Like, I mean, I think that if, you know, she saw a lost child, you know, at a mall, she would try to help that child home. But virulently anti-vaccine with just the rankest pseudoscience, obviously denying that germ theory even exists. So, and when I first encountered some of her writing and other anti-vaxxers, it wasn't obvious what the flaw of it was, right? So I would read, this vaccine has never been studied in a randomized controlled trial. That's a terror. These are the, you know, we're giving these to millions of people before they've even really been proven that they were tested in a randomized trial, but not proven to cause cancer in a randomized controlled trial. That's a travesty. But I just sort of learned to rebut all of the arguments. I wrote a book chapter about this with law professor Dori Reese. And Dr. Prasad is now saying the exact same things about Dr. Brogan as Dr. Brogan, just change measles and HPV. That's Dr. Brogan. And Dr. Prasad would say the exact same things about COVID. So they make the exact same arguments with the exact same language.
And they're also, you know, they're saying things that are more and more outrageous. I want to bring up two things that Vinay Prasad has done fairly recently, from what I remember. So first of all, he compared public health measures against COVID to a slippery slope that could lead to Nazi Germany. And also a blog post from October 12th, I think it was, many pediatricians are great. The American Academy of Pediatrics isn't and must be dissolved. Mm-hmm. Is he at the point where he just has to become more and more outrageous to keep the spotlight on him?
It seems that way. And by the way, Dr. Brogan said the exact same things about these health measures, comparing them to Hitler as Dr. Prasad did. So this is something I noticed actually with Dr. Brogan is when I first encountered the anti-vaccine movement in 2008 or 2009, you know, it was very cool and edgy to say that vaccines caused autism. You know, that was like, oh my God, I can't believe that you just said that. And by the time the pandemic came around, it was vaccines are part of a depopulation agenda. Mm-hmm. You know, they're out to sterilize us. You know, they just sort of got into, you know, in order to get attention and people to buy her products, she just had to continuously sort of say more outrageous things, it seemed. And yeah, I it does seem like Dr. Prasad has a little bit sort of fallen into that trap to where he says things like an advocate for pediatric COVID vaccines is off their rocker, you know, that we're crazy. And so I guess he said if our pandemic discourse becomes so, you know, uncivil, it's worse than COVID. So, well, thank you very much, Dr. Prasad. You know, things are now worse than COVID. You called me off my rocker. you know, but it, and there's no sort of room for nuance, right? He will never share, never, any of the 20 studies showing that the vaccine actually works in kids. He will never tell you simple numbers, how many children have died of COVID this pandemic, how many have been hospitalized. So, you know, he's sort of gotten himself into a trap where if he was just to tweet a simple fact, 1,500 children have died of COVID this pandemic, it's between 1,500 and 2,000, it'd be nuts, right? Like his fans would go wild. Why are you sharing this? What are you saying? You know, how many of them had comorbidities? So he's gotten to the point where he can't share simple facts because he's kind of, I think, trapped by this persona that he's, I don't want to say it's a persona because it's an act, because I don't think it's an act, but I think he's sort of trapped himself by his audience at this point. And same with Dr. Brogan. I mean, you know, there's no way she could ever say anything positive about any vaccine. It's just impossible for her. And that's the way Dr. Prasad is with pediatric COVID vaccines.
Yeah, you look at Prasad, you look at ZDogg MD, and they have a podcast together now, and they're using these very professional cameras to film themselves. They've got professional microphones. I think they're using the Shure microphones that Joe Rogan uses. Great lighting. Like, the whole thing looks very, very slick. They're both very charismatic. I mean, I can't stand them. I can't stand the tone of their voice, but, you know, putting that aside, they're very charismatic. They talk very easily and very casually on the microphone, especially ZDogg MD. And so that is a strong pull, right? I mean, charisma plays such a role in whom we decide to trust. And so even if they say things that aren't true, and even if they withhold important data, such as the one that you presented today, they just sound so confident, right?
Yeah, and they've sort of mastered a neat trick. I mean, Kelly Brogan has not been influential this pandemic. Andrew Wakefield has been completely unheard from. Thank you. You know, so these sort of quack doctors have, you know, they were kicked off social media. They've really seen, you know, no, the Washington Post isn't going to interview them. They don't have fancy credentials. They don't have large Twitter. You know, they've really seen their pandemic footprint shrink. What Dr. Prasad and ZDogg do is they position themselves as sort of in the middle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they sort of say, like, hey, we're not like those pandemic, this is a Bill Gates hoax type stuff.
Right. I'm a moderate.
We're also not like those people who want to vaccinate children. Sort of implying like
the rational middle.
Yeah, exactly right.
We're the sane ones here.
Correct. And because they say things like, you know, listen, this is really dangerous for grandma. Make sure she's vaccinated. They sound very credible. You know, Kelly Brogan would never say that. You know, so they seem very credible. They say, we really have to protect, you know, nursing homes and vulnerable people. But everyone else, you know, go to coughing parties and drink each other's spit or you're not really living.
right.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, they are very comfortable in front of a camera. I mean, and there's a podcast that you guys probably listen to as well called Conspirituality.
Yes.
You know, where they talk about most people like, you know, Kelly Brogan I'm blanking on her name, that obstetrician in Maine right now.
Krishan Northrup.
Yes, thank you very much.
The harp-playing lady.
Yeah, you know, who's become full-on QAnon, and this is a war between the light and dark. And though they talk a lot about this, and I don't think that as skeptics we really pay much attention to this, but we should, is how people sort of present themselves. And yes, this very confident, this, you know, I broke no doubt. I am data driven. I am nuanced. I am in the middle. And anyone who disagrees with me, as you heard from that little clip, is a mockable, shameful person.
Yeah, the aesthetics of rationality.
I like how when somebody says something a little bit nuanced and maybe sort of is a little bit flexible on some topic, they'll sort of quote tweet them and say, welcome to the middle ground, as if they've now somehow absorbed this person. And I'm like, I don't think you fully appreciate how little respect you have from most of the mainstream medical community.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that there's sort of a feedback loop where that means that they're onto something, you know, like it can feel very sort of empowering in some ways to think, I know stuff that the medical community doesn't. I mean, this was Dr. Brogan, you know, she had an extremely high opinion of herself. You know, I am awake. I am, you know, I know the truth. You know, everyone else is asleep and they're just sheep following the herd. And contrarian doctors like Dr. ZDogg, you know, in 2019, he sent out this tweet, here's some advice to medical students. You know, if 4 out of 5 doctors do something, make sure you're the fifth, you know, be the different one.
That sounds like a great way to fail your board exam, actually.
Right. I mean, you know, but it was an explicit sort of instruction to be different just for the sake of being different. And you saw that from the pandemic's first days. All of these guys were sort of saying, fear is a bigger problem. This is not going to be a big deal. Z-Dog, if you go back and listen to some of his early podcasts from the beginning of the pandemic, he's like, this is going to be nothing. This is just going to be a rounding error of the 1918 pandemic. I know people who would rather die of COVID than go through what we just went through.
I would rather die of COVID than not be able to sing karaoke with my friends for a short period of time.
Yep. He said stuff like that in the summer of 2020.
Let me stop you there. So a minute ago, we heard an ambulance siren on your end, Jonathan, and I was reminded of the fact that a lot of these contrarian doctors, they've never treated patients with COVID. But where were you in early 2020 in New York City?
Yeah, so I worked at Bellevue Hospital, here in Manhattan, and there were sirens going off everywhere. I've written about my experience there. Everyone has, read about it, but there's an incredible movement right now to even deny that COVID hit New York City hard, led by Jeffrey Tucker at the Brownstone Institute. They've published COVID, New York City denialism. It's basically, you don't want to compare anything to the Holocaust, but it's basically kind of Holocaust denialism, saying this tragedy never happened, even though it was only 2 years ago and it was extremely well documented. Everyone saw it. There were giant trucks outside the hospital. And, inside the hospital, I saw more people die in a week than I had in my entire career. Most of them were older, that's true. But I saw a 23-year-old die, a healthy 23-year-old die. I saw a 35-year-old die who did have diabetes. But it became clear that this virus could hurt a handful of young people. And unlike Dr. Ioannidis, what he said, this was not just people on their deathbed, moments away of dying of whatever they were going to die of normally when they happened to test positive for COVID. And I think all of the doctors that we spoke of, Dr. Prasad, I'm sure, has treated some COVID patients. Maybe Z-Dog has. But I don't think they saw exactly what the virus could do. Certainly not all of the sort of Stanford, protected people, Dr. Bhattacharya, Dr. Ioannidis, all of these people who experienced it only from their laptops, anyone who saw what COVID could do wouldn't say half of the statements that they make.
As we're recording this, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis just hosted a vaccine accountability roundtable with, among other people, there was Martin Kulldorff, there was Jay Bhattacharya, there was Joseph Latipo, who's Florida's Surgeon General, and Brett Weinstein, a former university professor turned conspiracy theorist podcaster. And the impression that I'm getting from this is of an anti-vaxxer-led witch trial that has now been politicized and given prominence through Ron DeSantis. And given DeSantis's key role in platforming these people, I worry that this could lead to a sort of institutionalized contrarianism with conspiracy ideation and revisionist history tendencies. What are your thoughts on where all of this is going now?
It's terrifying. I don't know. In the same way that the only people who've looked smart this pandemic are people who've refused to make predictions, wise people like that. Who knows where this is headed? I do think that more doctors are aware of the harm of medical misinformation. So before the pandemic, it was just sort of a lonely band of people. I was a bit player. I'm certainly not famous or anything, and I'm still not. But, David Gorski, Steve Novella, people like that. And it was kind of thought of
Christopher Labos.
But it's kind of thought of as a quirky thing, right? Like, the fact that I knew a lot about the anti-vaccine movement was kind of, if I was like a very good juggler, right? Like, okay, that's kind of cool. Like, it's like.
It was like a weird sideline that nobody really understood why you spent so much time doing it.
Correct. And I didn't, I only did it because I was interested in it. I didn't get any sort of academic appointments. I just found it fascinating for the same reason I'm a neurologist and a psychiatrist. I find it fascinating how people think. That's what this is all about. I lost my train of thought there. I'm gonna have to edit.
Well, let me read you that DeSantis tweeted that. DeSantis, he tweeted that Florida will hold the medical establishment accountable by 1, creating a grand jury to investigate messenger RNA shots and Big Pharma, 2, investigating cardiac-related deaths tied to the messenger RNA vaccines, and 3, forming a public health integrity committee to oversee the medical establishment, which I've seen some people refer to as like an alternative CDC of sorts. Yeah. I mean, this is, scary stuff.
Yeah, and when has a political trial ever come to a bad ending? Like, give me one historical example where a political trial ever ended badly for anybody involved.
Yeah, and you know, also on this committee are Tracy Hogue and someone named, I think, Joseph Freeman, who are other two doctors who've just spread wild anti-vaccine myths the entire pandemic. I mean, Tracy Hogue will treat anything about vaccine myocarditis, any sort of, you know, that's, you know, she's a sports medicine doctor who does all this sort of pseudoscience, you know, rich platelet plasma injections into people's knee, mm-hmm. suddenly becomes an expert in pediatric myocarditis and vaccine safety. You know, again,
sure. There's a lot of room under the big Substack tent. So come on in.
You know, none of these people will have any responsibility for ever treating a sick child. And I think that's appalling. You know, but this has the potential to be very scary, right? I mean, this is one thing where I sometimes disagree with, you know, my fellow skeptics about some of the laws to rein in medical misinformation, because I am a little wary of President Ron DeSantis making medical misinformation committees and making it a crime to, you know, support vaccines. So who knows where this is headed? But I do think doctors are becoming more alert to the problem of medical misinformation. This is being written about. It's being viewed as more important.
So to end on a productive and slightly optimistic and self-reflecting mood, in the comments section to one science-based medicine post about contrarians, there was a user called Sadmar who made an interesting comment that I wanted to bring up. They commented that people like Dr. Drew, whom we didn't mention, but who has also gone off the deep end, Dr. Drew, ZDog MD, and Prasad, that they were not doctors. They were media personalities who happened to hold medical degrees. I mean, technically they're both, but I understand the point that the user was making. It's a little bit like researchers who have a PhD in one discipline, but over the course of their research career, they end up researching things that are more and more removed from their PhD thesis until their PhD is just really just the start of the road that they're on and not who they are as researchers. And I wanted to bring up the fact that there's an argument to be made that I'm no longer a scientist, since I no longer work in a lab and do academic research. Chris still practices medicine, but also spends a lot of time speaking to the media and doing science communication himself. So my question to you, Jonathan, is that if we don't want to fall into that same trap of being removed from the practice that we comment on and becoming enamored with the sound of our own voice and courting those Substack dollars, if we don't want to fall into that same trap, what should we look out for?
The first thing to know is that you're vulnerable to it. Everything that you ever criticize anyone for could be applicable to you. Know also that you cannot figure out your own errors very easily, or else you wouldn't make them. So you have to be careful not to surround yourself in an echo chamber of sycophants. You have to be willing to listen when people tell you that you're wrong, seriously consider that you could be wrong, and be very willing to publicly admit if you're wrong. So I, you know, in my science-based medicine articles, I made a couple errors. You know, I quoted the wrong Dr. Bhattacharya in one thing, and it was pointed out to me. And the only way I could respond was, thank you very much for pointing out the error. I will fix that in my article, and I will make a note in the article that I made this error. That's it. That's it. I think that's the only thing that you can do, is try to be humble and listen to your critics.
Thank you very much for all of this. I also wanted to mention that you are working on a book about contrarian doctors during the pandemic, and I've had a brief look at it, and it looks really, really good. Do you want to talk a little bit about what motivated you to write this book?
Sure. I mean, the title of the book is called We Want Them Infected, and that comes from an email sent by epidemiologist Dr. Paul Alexander, who at the time was working for the Trump administration. And the title of the book is pretty self-explanatory. He wanted children and babies and toddlers and young adults to be infected with COVID before there was any vaccine, in order to create herd immunity. And there was, he was not alone. He was reflective of a very large international movement. I know I sound like a crazy conspiracy theorist myself, but to purposefully infect as many young people as possible with COVID, with the thought that this would be safe for them and this would end the pandemic. And in order to achieve these goals, doctors were willing to spin all sorts of yarns and spread all sorts of misinformation. And these are the doctors now who are against vaccinating children. Even today, they still want children to get COVID instead of getting the vaccine. They feel that's a positive good. And this sort of stuff before the pandemic, anyone who talked this way about measles or chickenpox was branded as a quack. Actually, Dr. Prasad did that to an anti-flu vaccine doctor, called him a quack. But that's now mainstream. So my book is really on the mainstreaming of the anti-vaccine movement, how it's become just a different idea now by people who would insist, I am not vaccine. I take great umbrage at being called anti-vaccine just because I'm against the COVID vaccine.
At what point of the publication process are you with this book?
Oh, it should be. I said I will turn this in to the publishers, very small place, no one's ever heard of it, in January 4th. And they said they're going to be able to turn it around pretty quickly. So hopefully it'll be good. The goal is to generate, not the goal, but I didn't start out this way, but I think it will generate outrage on every page, just all of the statements, just the misstatements, the misinformation. You know, in spring 2021, you know, now that the pandemic is over, you know, you need to stop living in fear. That article was published every month of the pandemic by one of these doctors. And it's a really sobering read if anyone finishes it. But I hope that, you know, it motivates people just not to be silent when they hear medical misinformation. I'm not trying to censor Dr. Prasad. I'm not trying to silence Dr. Prasad, but I'm trying to not look the other way when he just spreads blatant misinformation and incorrect facts.
How many lawsuits are you anticipating when this book gets published?
It's possible, you know, but I think people would be wary of this. My best defense is two things, that people would be wary of the Streisand effect, number one. Yeah. You know, nothing would bring more attention to my book than a lawsuit, so please, someone sue me. Yeah. And the second thing, of course, is that these people very much sort of say, you know, I'm being silenced, I'm being censored. So I think that they would be a little bit wary of trying to sue me into silence. Although I know that that's happened. I know there was a journalist who was thinking of writing an article on one of these doctors, and a lawsuit was threatened and she stopped. So it wow. worked.
I find that your book is, we're discussing this before the recording, it is a very comprehensive documentation of the two parallel realities during the pandemic, which is what actually happened and what these, and the sort of the fantasy world in which these contrarian doctors existed, and the predictions that they made, and the state of the situation that they would communicate to their fans, which had nothing to do with the actual state of, I mean, it's really remarkable to see those two parallel universes, and you are the bridge between the two, and you keep taking the reader from one to the other, and like, oh, here's a quote by Dr. Prasad. On this day, X number of Americans had died from COVID. It is very sobering, and I look forward to its publication.
Well, thanks. Yeah, no, I hope people read it. Thanks for giving it a plug. I worked hard on it.
Yes, it shows. And so before your book is published, if people want to find you and your work online, Dr. Jonathan Howard, where would they go?
So I'm the best place is Science-Based Medicine. I'm on Twitter for now, although I do plan on cutting back drastically very soon. But I'm at Joho19. I think that's where I'm at. I'm a little semi-anonymous there.
Or is it 19 Joho?
19 Joho. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Joho19 was taken. 19. Yes. There's a picture of my cat sleeping. So that's me. And some insults from another doctor. That's my bio.
Well, Dr. Jonathan Howard, thank you very much for your time and your expertise today.
Thanks. I enjoyed it. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
And that's the end of our show this month. Our theme music is Fall of the Ocean Queen by Joseph Hackle. Our illustrator is Luke Ouellette. If you want to support the show, find us on Patreon. All of our patrons get a bonus segment each month called Digressions. We're on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find Chris and me on Twitter as well. Our website is bodyofevidence.ca. The Body of Evidence is not affiliated with the McGill Office for Science and Society and is a production of 1254-0851 Canada Inc. And when trying to decide if a study is good or not, remember the Body of Evidence creed.
A study in mice is not a study in people.
Coincidences are easy, proving causation is hard.
Scientific studies are like movies. Some are just bad.
We can't stop at a single study. We have to look at the body of evidence.